Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. This is the final Old Mole of 2021, and it's my privilege to host. I'm Norm Diamond, and our producer, one of the many roles she plays for the Old Mole, is Patricia Kohlberg. Today also is the Old Mole's final opportunity to participate in KBOO's end of the year fund drive. We have a true variety hour this morning with poetry, music, an interview, a review and commentary. I've lots to tell you about that, but before I do, here's Patricia.
A quick reminder for our listeners that KBOO is in its final week of our end of year membership drive, and we are oh so close to meeting our goal of raising $45,000. You can help push us over the finish line by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, 97214. All donations until year's end will be matched dollar for dollar up to $8,000 by a generous grant from a group of anonymous supporters. KBOO focuses on our local community, our artists and activists, and keeps you informed about issues that matter to you.
Just to repeat, all donations that come in today through the very few remaining days in 2021 will be worth double. If you are able, please do what you can to keep the station going. As the last Old Mole of the year, I want to pause a bit to remember where we are in time. One of my all-time favorite authors is Eduardo Galeano, a Uruguayan writer of anecdotes and parables. One of his last books before he died in 2015 was Los Hijos de los Días, Children of the Days, in which he highlighted a significant event in history specific to each day of the calendar. Here are a couple of his stories from just the last 10 days. For December 17th, he wrote, "The Little Flame. On this morning in 2010, as on every other morning, Muhammad Bouazizi was hauling his cart filled with fruit and vegetables somewhere in Tunis. As on every other morning, the police arrived to collect the levy they had concocted. But this morning, Muhammad refused to pay. The policemen beat him, overturned his cart, and stomped all over his fruit and vegetables splattered on the ground. Muhammad then doused himself from head to foot with gasoline and set himself on fire. In a few days, that little flame, no taller than a street vendor, grew to encompass the entire Arab world, ablaze with people tired of being nobody." Thus spoke Eduardo Galeano, referring, of course, to the Arab Spring. And for December 24th, a miracle. On Christmas Eve in 1991, the Soviet Union passed away, and in the manger, Russian capitalism was born. The new faith worked a miracle, transfigured apparatchiks turned into businessmen. Communist Party leaders changed religion and became brazen nouveau riche, who put a for sale sign on the state and bought everything buyable in their country and the world for the price of bananas. Not even football clubs escape. I'll plan to bring you more of these pithy stories on the appropriate days in the coming year. Also, before we leave 2021, there's a centenary we should acknowledge. 100 years ago, in 1921, was the largest armed worker uprising in U.S. history. It's known as the Battle of Blair Mountain and happened in West Virginia. You've heard of the Hatfield-McCoy rivalry, a staple in American folklore, two families killing each other off over decades, even while a woman from one side loved a man from the other, Romeo and Juliet style. That was all late 1800s. By 1920, Sid Hatfield was police chief in the town of Matewan. If the town's name sounds familiar, it's probably because John Sayles made a great movie about this 1920s labor struggle and gave it that title. This later Hatfield was an ally of the coal miners attempting to organize. When the mine owners brought in armed mercenaries to stop the organizing and evict miners from their homes, Hatfield confronted them. The ensuing gunfight left 7 of the mercenaries dead. The next year, coal company guards assassinated an unarmed Hatfield on the courthouse steps. The union that miners were building included blacks and whites, native-born and immigrant. It's one of the good examples we have in our history of what might have been if it had been allowed to continue. As both a union and interracial, the United Mine Workers of America, in that early version, was a threat to elites, both local and national. Conditions in the mines were already brutal. Health and safety precautions, other than the miners' own attempts to look out for each other, were non-existent. Kill a mule, buy another. Kill a man, hire another, was how the miners understood their bosses' economic calculus. Hatfield's murder sent the miners on a march to the county seat. Along the way, they faced deputized mercenaries with machine guns furnished by the mine owners. They faced strafing and bombing by the U.S. Army Air Force and infantry troops sent by U.S. President Warren Harding. For nearly a week, the miners, many of them veterans of World War I, fought back. Almost 100 of them died, with hundreds wounded. Eventually, close to 1,000 of them were charged as criminals, with many sent to prison. The union was bankrupted trying to defend against the legal charges. With nearly a free rein for the bosses as a result, living and working conditions for the miners became even worse. They continued to organize, but it took another 40 years to reestablish the UMWA as a stalwart in the U.S. labor movement. What lesson do you want to draw about armed resistance? For now, I'll leave that to you, but I don't want to let 2021 pass without remembering the valiant miners of exactly 100 years before. From those Appalachian miners to today's Northwest loggers, from labor environmentalism to a remarkable letter from a freed slave to his former master, we have a labor theme on today's program. As we explore that theme, I'd like to introduce a newcomer to the Old Mole. Matt Witt is a writer and photographer living in Southern Oregon. We'll hear him again later in the program. For now, though, I'd like to let him introduce himself by way of a poem he wrote last year, just after he and his wife had to evacuate their home as the climate-fueled wildfire approached. 1/3 of his town was destroyed, including most of the affordable housing. With the fire raging, he wrote The Executioner's Face.
We load the car, 2 sets of clothes and a lifetime of memories. As skyscraper flames are destroying hundreds of homes of friends and neighbors a mile away. Did they get out in time? Will we? And then what? We hit the back roads, searching for safety, with Bob Dylan howling through car speakers. The soles of my feet, I swear they're burning. Decades of reports said this was coming without climate action. Hotter temperatures, disappearing snowpack, more frequent and more intense fires, urgent transition needed to solar, rapid investment in energy efficiency. We can already picture the photos the media will feed us of some scraggly guy with stringy hair who may have dropped a match, with headlines, "What caused the fire?" There will be no photos of corporate lobbyists whose puppets for years said, "Let's double down on what got us here," or who gave us half measures and asked for applause. We drive through the smoke, community destroyed, and now Dylan's voice is sounding more desperate. "The executioner's face," he wails, "is always well hidden."
That was Matt Witt with his fire-inflected poem, fiery in its own right, "The Executioner's Face." Matt's poem suggests our music for today's program. Thanks to the Old Moles resident Bob Dylanologist and Dylanophile, Tom Becker, for identifying the Bob Dylan references in Matt's poetry. Here's just a bit of Dylan's song, "It's a Hard Rain's Gonna Fall," that contains the line, "The executioner's face is always well hidden."
And what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm a-going back out for the rain starts a-falling. I'll walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison, and the executioner's face is always well hidden. Where hunger is ugly, where the souls are forgotten, where black is the color, where none is the number. And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it, and reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, it's a hard rains are gonna fall.
Matt Witt will return later with a review of a recent novel about loggers in our region. Bill Resnick will give us the second part of his conversation with labor environmentalist Jeremy Brecher. And I'll bring you that extraordinary letter I mentioned from a formerly enslaved worker whose master is begging him to come back south. Before we turn to Bill and Jeremy, here's Patricia.
Hey, Portland, it's your last chance this year to support KBOO, your non-commercial, volunteer-powered radio station. This is the radio station that brings you the news, reviews, and views that you are not going to hear on commercially sponsored radio. This is the final week of our funding drive, and every dollar you donate will be matched up to $8,000 through a generous grant from KBOO supporters. You're listening now because you like what you hear on KBOO, your community-powered radio station. So help keep us on the air by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321.
Thank you, Patricia. Last week, Bill Resnick talked with Jeremy Brecher from the Labor Network for Sustainability. You may know Brecher as the author of the outstanding labor history, Strike, with an exclamation mark. More recently, he's written Climate Insurgency, A Strategy for Survival. Bill and Jeremy continue their conversation this week, focusing on the grassroots actions and climate action movements that do hold promise. If you're so inspired, you can find last week's part one at the Old Moles page on KBOO's website. Here's part two. Bill?
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to Jeremy Brecher, who's written a whole lot on the climate crisis and how people can, in fact, form movements that could successfully deal with it. I think that's coming, and it can come soon. Jeremy, I think we want to validate your observation of the multitude of movements that in so many areas are emulating and creating programs that resemble the programs and ideas envisioned within the Green New Deal. There really is a greater program that people can fit into and integrate themselves and begin gaining commitments, not just to the individual issue that the program addresses or the demand or the struggle addresses, but in fact the larger vision when all the programs that meet to coalesce. But we can't talk about all of them, but I hope that you maybe give us some examples of what cities are doing. Some of the cities in the red states are doing that are so promising as to climate change itself.
So let me just give out of scores and scores of examples. In fact, there are 600 local governments across the United States that have adopted climate action plans. We're setting greenhouse gas reduction targets. Not all of them are actually implementing very much, but that gives you some sense of at least how widespread the concern is at a city level. And I can give some examples where there are serious attempts to at least begin implementing the Green New Deal from below type programs. So you mentioned Massachusetts and the community choice aggregation, which is possible in a number of states. I think California is the one that is farthest ahead, but the Massachusetts example that I'm most familiar with is a town called Swampscott, Massachusetts, which launched a community choice aggregation program called Swampscott Community Power. And what these community choice aggregation programs do is allow the residents of a city to bargain collectively with the power companies. They can bargain for better rates, but they can also bargain for cleaner electricity. And that's what the people in Swampscott did. It's a little town, but in the first year of its program, it reduced the carbon footprint of the town by 9,700 tons of carbon dioxide, which would be the equivalent of removing 2,000 passenger cars from the roads. And that's just one city and one step. Also, one of my favorite examples is from the town of Somerset, Massachusetts, which was the home to the Brayton Point coal-fired power plant, which was shut down after a long campaign by community members and clean energy folks. And I actually went to the community college there while they were struggling over whether to close the plant and gave a talk about what we often refer to as just transition. What can you do to provide an alternative for the workers who are in a fossil fuel plant, like a power plant that's going to be closed down, and also for the community, which is going to lose a major taxpayer and a major community institution? And I don't know if my talk had any impact, probably not, but whatever led to it, the town decided, first of all, it was decided to shut the plant down, but instead of just saying, well, there's going to be all kinds of bad consequences and there's nothing we can do about it, instead the town conducted a visioning process for town residents that they called Reimagining Brayton Point. And they discussed, and they brought in designers and planners and experts of various kinds to figure out what could they do with this site. And then they had a major cleanup, and the site is now being redeveloped as a center for logistics, manufacturing, and support for offshore wind, which is also something that, since I was out there, has been developing very fast on the Massachusetts coast. So that is another example, and this is very much oriented both toward job creation and toward the drive to close the coal-fired power plant was very much driven by the health impacts that it was having on poor neighborhoods in the Braden Point area. So that's one. And let me just add one more, although, as I say, there are scores, if not hundreds, and I hope there's going to be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds before too long. But City of Portland decided...
I was going to mention that KBOO is a Portland station, Jeremy.
Oh, okay.
Probably most of our listeners were involved in that struggle for the tax on big companies to create our own, in the city, solar installations as well as insulation of homes. It's a pretty large program.
Right. Portland's program is becoming a national model and inspiration for Green New Deal from below type programs. The Portland Clean Energy Community Benefits Fund is applying exactly Green New Deal type principles to the climate protection and economic development in Portland. And first of all, the tax on big retailers like Walmart, the idea that we're going to tax the wealthy corporations and investments in order to do the things we need to do is a core idea of the Green New Deal. And Portland has proved that you don't have to wait for the federal government to do it. You can start doing it locally. And then the fund, as I'm sure most of our listeners there know, is specifically oriented towards creating jobs for underserved communities and both energy efficiency and also conservation and energy efficiency, so we can use less energy at the same time that we're producing it through solar panels on rooftops and other forms of renewable energy. So the Portland program is actually a nationally recognized example of the Green New Deal from below, and one that I hope will catch on in a lot of other places.
Yeah, it was wonderful. It was also wonderful partly because the Sierra Club and 350 PDX that ran it enlisted so many volunteers to put it on the ballot. It was a ballot initiative, of course. In fact, it was so popular that the two big investor-owned utilities that serve Portland, Pacific Power and PGE, not to be confused with California's PG&E that has its $32 billion worth of damages from their grid, they had to allow it. They've been extremely, though, effective in this state in keeping complete control over the installation of rooftop solar or small other kinds of neighborhood solar, community solar. All of them are still required to. The legislation is very bad, and they've won it, and they're very powerful in the state, and unfortunately powerful in our city council. But we showed them what we could do, it seems to me. And there are now people in Portland talking about building out our own power supply, very cheap and reliable, especially in emergencies. That's another thing that's interesting that's happening. Hi, folks. This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, on planet Earth. But first, a message from our sponsor, from all of us at KBOO who love this station that tells truth to power, that comforts the afflicted and afflicts the excessively comfortable, and does music from the grassroots and avoids the commercial stuff. I also love KBOO because you hear from some of the most thoughtful and inspiring people on this planet. Jeremy Brecker is one of the eminent labor and environmental historians of our time, along with Noam Chomsky and Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Mark Jacobson, Barbara Ransby, Barbara Fields, Michelle Alexander, Gar Alperovitz. I could go on and on and on with people ignored by establishment media. But they're featured on KBOO along with hundreds of others, not just national figures, also local people fighting for justice and democracy. If you're worried about the state of the world and want to save the planet for future generations, if you want to get informed on the movements and projects that are shaping our world and shaping our city, movements showing the way to that better possible democratic, sustainable, and necessary world, and also not just the world, but Portland too, then we on Old Mill Collective, we urge you to support this wonderful radio station and go to the KABU website, become a member, make a donation. Every bit helps. Big bits are also appreciated. And when the epidemic is over, we can then congregate at our studio in Southeast 8th, work together to make radio. And that, with that vital interruption, we turn to the interview with Jeremy Brecker. Jeremy, let's in fact do a few more examples. Now, you're one of the co-founders of the Labor Network for Sustainability. I know you followed closely and made great efforts to enlist whole unions in your network or other networks that are of the energy democracy movement has begun. Tell us, not just unionized workers, well, there's a whole set of efforts by workers. Some, why don't you tell us about that, and then we can conclude.
Well, the labor movement, as your listeners probably know, has been kind of divided on climate issues, and there have been strong individuals and unions and groups advocating for climate protection, both because we need it as a society and because there are plenty of good jobs that are going to be created by climate protection. But there's also a significant sector of organized labor that has portrayed climate protection policy as a threat to existing jobs or potential jobs, and that division is ongoing throughout much of the labor movement. But there are many unions that have been strongly advocating for climate protection and engaging in their own Green New Deal from below type programs to start implementing climate protection on their own. So, for example, the Service Employees Union, SEIU, starting in New York and then spreading to other places, has been extremely active in training and empowering building maintenance workers to combat the tremendous waste of energy through fossil fuel burning that has gone on. In New York City, the primary, the largest source of greenhouse gases is buildings, because you got all those high buildings and you've got a lot of public transit, so that reduces the transportation share of greenhouse gases, but all those buildings increase the share of buildings. And so reducing greenhouse gas emissions from buildings is a crucial part of climate protection in New York City, also other places as well, but New York SEIU was a pioneer in this. So what they did was, first of all, encourage employers to do the kinds of things you need to do to reduce emissions from a building in terms of better heating equipment and cooling equipment and better insulation and fixing of windows, weatherization, all that kind of thing. But then when they had the new equipment and technologies, they said, you know, these are only as good as the people who manage them. If we have fancy computerized thermostatic systems to control a building, and we're talking about buildings that are, you know, 50, 100 stories high, huge operations with huge fuel consumption, it doesn't do that much good to have a fancy thermostat if we don't have people who know how to operate it. So what they did was start creating training programs for, and they're actually bargained for these in the union contracts, for programs. The first one was called 1,000 Green Supers, that you would have train 1,000 SEIU building maintenance workers in how to manage their buildings in a energy-efficient, climate-friendly way. And then it's going on to become just a regular part of union training and the training for the building services workers throughout New York and now throughout that whole region. So that's had major impact on reducing fossil fuel emissions from buildings, initiated by SEIU. Many of your listeners are probably familiar with Recology, which started in the San Francisco area and has now spread through a lot of the West Coast. It is a worker-owned co-op that is devoted to the zero-waste system of getting rid of our garbage and trash. And Recology is, it's a unionized recycling co-op. It was largely initiated by the Teamsters, and it services over 700,000 residences in the Bay Area and over 100,000 commercial customers in California. And I see from my notes here that it includes Oregon and Washington also. And it has been a significant way of reducing pollution, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and creating jobs, which are very substantial proportion go to people who have been low income, discriminated against minorities, African American and others. So it really embodies the jobs and justice as well as the environmental and climate dimensions of the Green New Deal. And let me also mention the work of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW. There are activities going on for clean energy in many parts of the country, spearheaded by IBEW. The one that I'm most familiar with is Local 11, which is in Los Angeles, which has been actually working for years on developing a training program for electrical workers, for electricians, that is designed to train them for energy efficiency programs. And they actually created a building. They have a partnership on these efforts, the training efforts, with their contractors, and they created the first Net Zero Plus Electrical Training Institute, which is a building that actually, it's not only net zero, it's not only carbon emissions free, but it actually produces more electricity than it uses, and the rest of it goes out and is used for other purposes. They took an existing building and retrofitted it, and they used that to train electricians and apprentice electricians in the Los Angeles area to be able to go in and retrofit buildings with a wide range of different energy technologies, including electrical vehicle charging, battery storage, microgrids, energy dashboards, lighting, and other programs that turn buildings that are producing vast amounts of greenhouse gases into ones that are actually neutral or even producing more energy than they use.
One of my, reading your article, one of my favorite examples, one of the examples I remember best is the railroad workers who on their own got together and developed plans for and methods for reducing, my guess is, the diesel fuels and all the rest of the problems that railroad yards create in cities. A real problem, actually, in Portland, Oregon, that has a big yard on the east side commercial district. Right. Jeremy, you get the last word, and then we're going to sign off.
Thanks very much for having this conversation and having me on for it. As I said, Portland is definitely inspiring other places around the country with its programs, and there's a long way to go even in Portland, but the way we're going shows that it can actually be both a way to achieve climate safety, a way to increase the justice of our communities, and a way to create a whole lot of jobs for people who need jobs. And I think those are the core themes of the Green New Deal, and the fact that you in Portland and other people around the country are doing it even before we get any significant support from the federal government through a Green New Deal from below is something that we may well look back on the way we look back at popular participation in the original New Deal and say this was not just a federal government plan, but this was a huge movement in which millions and millions of people participated, and that's why it was able to make a transformation that was so desperately needed.
Yeah, you can be sure that Portland folks will be part of that great movement that occurs. And in fact, even in Portland, there are so many other, even with PG&E, Pacific Power, and the lumber industry so important in the state, and so radically conservative of their profits. It seems to me they're being challenged in many ways. And when the time comes and people awake, Portland certainly will be a hotbed of resistance as well as advance and towards, in fact, a clean, green, democratic, and sustainable economy. Jeremy Brecker, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Nice to be with you, and very great to have this conversation with you and your listeners.
Thanks, Bill and Jeremy Brecker. We're in the home stretch of KABU's end-of-the-year fund drive, a necessity for keeping KABU going. Here again is Patricia Kullberg.
It's time to remind you that your beloved community radio station, KABU, needs money to survive, and 80% of the funds that keep KABU alive come from donors like you. And right now is the perfect time to donate, because every one of your dollars will be matched up to a total of $8,000 through a grant from a group of anonymous donors. That offer ends on December 31st, so do the right thing and make your donation today. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or mail us some money at KBOO 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland 97214. And a big thanks to everyone who has already given to keep community radio alive in Portland.
Earlier in the program, I introduced Matt Witt through his poetry. He wrote that poem, The Executioner's Face, while the wildfire was still raging. Matt brings an important perspective to the Old Mole, having worked both for forest workers' unions and environmental groups. Here he reviews a new novel, Damnation Spring, by Ash Davidson, that focuses on a Pacific Northwest logging family facing changes that threaten their livelihood and their health. Matt's a terrific photographer as well as writer. His note to me reminds us, for generations, the Pacific Northwest has seen our forests and our labor exploited by wealthy outside interests who extract our wealth and then move on, leaving behind environmental destruction, unemployment, and struggling communities. Here's his review.
Every time there is a dispute about logging in the Pacific Northwest, most of the news media tell a simple story filled with stereotypes. On one side, there are environmentalists who care only about fish and birds. And on the other side, there are loggers who care only about jobs. In real life, though, it's not that simple. And that's one reason that the new novel, Damnation Spring, is so valuable. Damnation Spring is a page-turner, filled with suspense and drama. But it also paints a rare, complex picture of the people who live and work in our logging communities. The novel takes place on California's Redwood Coast, just south of the Oregon border. The main characters are a white couple named Rich and Colleen. Rich is a logger who works for a big non-union company. Colleen is a midwife who helps local women give birth. Both come from families that have lived in that small community for many generations. And neither of them has ever been more than 100 miles from home. But against their will, rapid changes are coming that threaten their livelihood, their health, their bonds with friends and neighbors, and even their marriage. Jobs are disappearing as corporate speculators from outside the area profit from clear-cutting and then take the money and run. In their wake, they leave huge mudslides and streams that, with less shade and more silt, are too warm to support salmon anymore. At the same time, women like Colleen and the expectant mothers she helps are noticing an alarming increase in miscarriages. They also are starting to question why their bees are dying and their hens are giving birth to deformed chicks. A member of the Yurok tribe who is testing local water sources for contamination by herbicides has answers. But if people like Rich and Colleen let themselves listen to the evidence, that could jeopardize the few logging paychecks that are left. The author of Damnation Spring, Ash Davidson, was born in Redwoods Country, the daughter of a carpenter and a school teacher. She does a masterful job of showing that logging families are actually the first ones impacted by corporate disregard for environmental protection and worker safety. They pay the price every day with chronic pain, broken bones, and too often their lives. And it is their drinking water, their recreation spots, their quality of life that suffers first. Davidson is also just a good storyteller. She captures the constant banter among the men that allows them to relate to each other without showing too much of their feelings. She shows how fragile the threads of trust can be between married partners, and she lets everyone have their say. In one scene, eco-protesters chain themselves to a barricade across a logging road in hopes of saving some of the only remaining old-growth redwoods. They tell the loggers who come to move them out of the way that once the big trees are clear-cut, there will be no more work. You're only hurting yourselves, one shouts. You think the company gives a damn about you? You're working yourselves out of a job. A Yurok elder, testifying at a hearing about logging permits, tells the mostly white audience, "We have lived right here, along this river, for 100 generations, and we're still here. When the salmon and deer and clean water are all gone," he asks, "what will you eat then? Money?" And Rich, the logger, testifying at the same hearing, explains that families like his are left with the worst of all worlds. "You won't find a guy that loves the woods more than a logger," he says. "We hunt, we fish, we camp out. This is home. We know how to feed our families," he says. "All we're asking is you let us do that." Environmentalists, loggers, indigenous tribes, they're all harmed by the same big money interests. And they could fight back if only they could join forces. Damnation Spring shows how hard that would be to accomplish, but also how important.
That powerful review was by Matt Witt, a review of the new novel Damnation Spring by Ash Davidson. And now, this breaking announcement from Patricia Kohlberg.
Programs on KABU, like the Old Mole Variety Hour, bring you news, reviews, and interviews you're not going to hear on commercially sponsored radio stations. KABU reports from the ground up with a diversity of voices. If you value the alternative perspectives that programs like The Old Mole put on the air, show your support by donating today. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321, or you can put a check in the mail to KABU at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Every dollar you donate today will be matched up to $8,000 through a grant from a group of KABU supporters. Thanks to everyone who has given already to keep KABU alive and on the air.
We'll hear from Patricia one more time. Before we do, I'd like to return to our labor theme. We've heard about a miners' strike of 100 years ago and about loggers in our own day trapped by outside capital, diminishing job possibilities, and a devastated environment. We've heard, too, about environmental actions and their potential by labor forces working together with others. Do you think of slavery and this country's sordid history of slavery as a labor issue? W.E.B. Du Bois had a breakthrough insight way back in the 1930s when he wrote about the Civil War being ended by a general strike. His argument was that the withdrawal of their labor by slaves fleeing plantations was what forced the South to capitulate. At the start of the Civil War, the South had a decided advantage. Because of slave labor, it could continue producing cotton for sale abroad and food for its troops and population with little disruption. Poor whites, relatively insignificant in the Southern economy, could be sent off to fight and die. For the North, on the other hand, building an army meant turning workers into soldiers, pulling them from productive jobs. It was only when 500,000 black workers, slaves, left their plantations and hid out or headed north that production faltered and the tide of battle decisively turned. A general strike, if you will. Was it coordinated? We still don't know adequately the means or extent of communication among Southern slaves. One consequence was that the South faced a labor shortage after the war. Not that there weren't workers, but that they no longer would work under slave-like conditions. Southern elites eventually solved this problem by mobilizing poor whites to create a reign of terror against blacks who had stayed. In the interim, though, and in a little-known part of the story, they went looking for their former slaves who had fled, hoping to entice them back. Slave owners, like many ruling classes, had created an image, a story they told themselves and others to justify their oppression. They wrote, or had others write, poems and stories, essays and editorials about how benign their rule was and how attached their slaves were to their loving masters. Thus, it's no surprise that when Colonel P.H. Anderson of Big Spring, Tennessee, tracked down his former slave, Jordan Anderson, now living in Dayton, Ohio, after the war, the colonel wrote the former slave about all the good times they had shared. I won't bother you with the colonel's distorted and self-serving memories, but Jordan Anderson's response is an American classic. Here's what he wrote. To my old master, Colonel P.H. Anderson, Big Spring, Tennessee. Sir, I got your letter and was glad to find that you had not forgotten Jordan and that you wanted me to come back and live with you again, promising to do better for me than anybody else can. I have often felt uneasy about you. I thought the Yankees would have hung you long before this for harboring Rebs they found in your house. I suppose they never heard about your going to Colonel Martin's to kill the Union soldier that was left by his company in their stable. Although you shot at me twice before I left you, I did not want to hear of your being hurt, and am glad you are still living. It would do me good to go back to the dear old home again and see Miss Mary and Miss Martha and Alan, Esther, Green, and Lee. Give my love to them all, and tell them I hope we will meet in the better world, if not in this. I would have gone back to see you all when I was working in the Nashville hospital, but one of the neighbors told me Henry intended to shoot me if he ever got a chance. I want to know particularly what the good chance is you propose to give me. I am doing tolerably well here. I get $25 a month with victuals and clothing, have a comfortable home for Mandy, the folks here call her Mrs. Anderson, and the children, Millie, Jane, and Grundy, go to school and are learning well. The teacher says Grundy has a head for a preacher. They go to Sunday school, and Mandy and me attend church regularly. We are kindly treated. Sometimes we overhear others saying, "Them colored people were slaves down in Tennessee." The children feel hurt when they hear such remarks, but I tell them it was no disgrace in Tennessee to belong to Colonel Anderson. Many darkies would have been proud, as I used to was, to call you master. Now, if you will write and say what wages you will give me, I will be better able to decide whether it would be to my advantage to move back again. As to my freedom, which you say I can have, there is nothing to be gained on that score, as I got my free papers in 1864 from the Provost Marshal General of the Department at Nashville. Mandy says she would be afraid to go back without some proof that you are sincerely disposed to treat us justly and kindly. And we have concluded to test your sincerity by asking you to send us our wages for the time we served you. This will make us forget and forgive old scores and rely on your justice and friendship in the future. I served you faithfully for 32 years and Mandy 20 years. At $25 a month for me and $2 a week for Mandy, our earnings would amount to $11,680. Add to this the interest for the time our wages has been kept back, and deduct what you paid for our clothing and three doctor's visits to me and pulling a tooth for Mandy, and the balance will show what we are in justice entitled to. Please send the money by Adams Express in care of V. Winters, Esquire, Dayton, Ohio. If you fail to pay us for faithful labors in the past, we can have little faith in your promises in the future. We trust the good Maker has opened your eyes to the wrongs which you and your fathers have done to me and my fathers in making us toil for you for generations without recompense. Here, I draw my wages every Saturday night, but in Tennessee, there was never any payday for the Negroes, any more than for the horses and cows. Surely there will be a day of reckoning for those who defraud the laborer of his hire. In answering the letter, please state if there would be any safety for my Millie and Jane, who are now grown up and both good-looking girls. You know how it was with poor Matilda and Catherine. I would rather stay here and starve and die, if it comes to that, than have my girls brought to shame by the violence and wickedness of their young masters. You will also please state if there has been any school opened for the colored children in your neighborhood. The great desire of my life now is to give my children an education and have them form virtuous habits. P.S. Say howdy to George Carter and thank him for taking the pistol from you when you were shooting at me. From your old servant, Jordan Anderson. I found that letter in Robert Paul Wolfe's book, Autobiography of an Ex-White Man, a book I'll tell you about in a future broadcast. I'd like to thank Old Moles Bill Resnick and Matt Witt, John Nelson for his editing, Patricia Kohlberg for producing, and Bill's guest, Jeremy Brecher. Thanks also and always to the KABU staff for heroic work under difficult circumstances. In Matt's poem, we heard the line, "The soles of my feet, I swear they're burning. That's a quote from Bob Dylan's The Wicked Messenger. We'll hear a bit of that song as we go out. For the last word, I'm going to turn you over to Patricia Kullberg. This has been Norm Diamond. Tune into The Old Mole next Monday. Stay safe and stay active. Patricia?
Finally, to our listeners, you can show support for the Old Mole Variety Hour and for KBOO by donating today and helping KBOO reach our $45,000 goal for this end-of-year drive. We are very close to meeting our goal. Please become a member of the KBOO community today by going to kboo.fm/give, by texting KBOO to 44321, or by mailing a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Every dollar you donate today and up until December 31st will be matched up to $8,000 through a grant from a group of KBOO supporters. It's a great time to give, and thanks to everyone out there who has already given so generously in support of community radio.
There was a wicked messenger from Eli, he did come with a mind that multiplied the smallest matter. When questioned who had sent for him, he answered with his thumb, for his tongue yet could not speak but only flatter. Stayed behind the assembly hall, it was there he made his bed. Oftentimes he could be seen returning, until one day he just appeared with a note in his hand which read, "The soles of my feet, I swear they're burning.